My father was, he's on the left here, my father was officer of the general staff of the Soviet Army. He was inspector of land forces, Soviet troops stationed in countries like Mongolia, Cuba, East European countries. This is the picture taken at the entrance of my Institute of Oriental Languages. It's a part of Moscow State University. As every Soviet student, I was, quote-unquote, volunteering for harvesting grain in Kazakhstan. By the end of my training in school, I was recruited by the KGB. This picture was taken on that day, and you can see again how happy it feels to be recruited by the KGB. Pay special attention to number of bottles on the table. One of my functions was to keep foreign guests permanently intoxicated the moment they land at Moscow airport. In 1967, the KGB attached me to this magazine, Look magazine. A group of 12 people arrived to USSR from the United States to cover the 50th anniversary of October Socialist Revolution in my country. From the first page to the last page, it was a package of lies.
Our conversation is with Mr. Yuri Alexandrovich Bezmenov. Mr. Bezmenov was born in 1939 in a suburb of Moscow. He was the son of a high-ranking Soviet Army officer. He was educated in the elite schools inside the Soviet Union and became an expert in Indian culture and Indian languages. He had an outstanding career with Novosti, which was the, and still is, I should say, the press arm or the press agency of the Soviet Union. It turns out that this is also a front for the KGB. One of his interesting assignments was to brainwash foreign diplomats when they visited Moscow. And he'll tell us a little bit about how they did this and how they planted information which eventually wound up in the press of the free world. He escaped to the West in 1970 after becoming totally disgusted with the Soviet system, and he did this at great risk to his life. He certainly is one of the world's outstanding experts on the subject of Soviet propaganda and disinformation and active measures. Mr. Bezmenov, I'd like to begin by having you tell us a little bit about some of your childhood memories.
Well, the most vivid memory of my childhood was Second World War, or to be more precise, the end of the Second World War, when all of a sudden the United States, from a friendly nation which helped us to defeat Nazism, turned overnight into a deadly enemy. And it was very shocking because all newspapers were trying to present an image of belligerent, aggressive American imperialism. Most of the things that we were taught is that the United States is aggressive power, which is just about to invade our beautiful, free, socialist country, that American CIA is dropping Colorado beetles on our beautiful potato fields to eliminate our crops, and each schoolboy had a picture of Colorado bug on the back page of his notebook, and we were instructed to go into collective fields to search for those little Colorado bugs. Of course, we couldn't find any, neither we could find many potatoes, and that was explained again by the encroachments of the decadent imperialist power. The anti-American paranoia, hysteria in the Soviet propaganda was to such an of such a higher degree that many less skeptical people or less stubborn would really believe that the United States is just about to invade our beautiful motherland, and some secretly hope that it will come true.
That's interesting.
Yes.
Well, getting back to life inside the Soviet Union or inside communist countries in general, in this country, at the university level primarily, we read and hear that the Soviet system is different from ours, but not that different, and that there is a convergence developing between all of the systems of the world, and that really doesn't make an awful lot of difference what system you live under, because you have corruption and dishonesty and tyranny and all that sort of thing. From your personal experience, what is the difference between life under communism and life in the United States?
Well, life is obviously very much different for simple reason that the Soviet Union is a state capitalist economically. It's a state capitalism where an individual has absolutely no rights, no value. His life is nothing. It's just like an insect. He is disposable. Whereby in the United States, even the worst criminal is treated as a human being. He has a fair trial, and some of them capitalize on their crimes. They publish their memoirs in their prisons and get handsomely paid by your crazy publishers. Differences, of course, in the daily life are very various, depending on who we are talking about. In my own private life, I never suffered from communism simply because I was brought up in a family of high-ranking military officers. Most of the doors were open for me. Most of my expenses were paid by the government. And I never had any troubles with the authorities or with the police. So, in other words, I would say I enjoyed, or I had good reasons to enjoy, all the advantages of so-called socialist system. Mm-hmm. My main motivations to defect had nothing to do with affluence. It was mainly moral indignation, moral protest, rebellion against the inhuman methods of the Soviet system.
Well, specifically, what did you object to?
I objected, first of all, against oppression of my own dissidents and intellectuals. And that was the most disgusting thing that I witnessed as a young man, young student, who was brought up a very troublesome period in our history, from Stalin to Khrushchev, from total tyranny and oppression to some kind of liberalization. Second, when I started working for the Soviet embassy in India, to my horror, I discovered that we are millions of times more oppressive than any colonial or imperialist power in the history of mankind, that my country brings to India not freedom, progress, and friendship between the nations, but racism, exploitation, and slavery, and of course economical inefficiency to this country. Since I fell in love with India, I developed something which by KGB standards is extremely dangerous thing. It's called split loyalty. When an agent likes a country of assignment more than his own country, I literally fell in love with this beautiful country, a country of great contrasts, but also great humility, great tolerance, and its philosophical and intellectual freedoms. My ancestors used to live in caves and eat raw meat when India was a highly civilized nation 6,000 years ago. So obviously the choice was not to the advantage of my own nation. I decided to defect and to entirely dissociate myself from that brutal regime.
Mr. Bezmenov, we've read a lot about the concentration camps and the slave labor camps under the Stalin regime. Now the general impression in America is that those things are part of the past. Are they still going on today, or what is the status?
Yes. There is no qualitative change in the Soviet concentration camp system. There are changes in numbers of prisoners. Again, this is unreliable Soviet statistics. We don't know how many political prisoners are there in the Soviet concentration camps. But we sure know from various sources that at each particular time there are close to 25 to 30 million of Soviet citizens who are virtually kept as slaves in forced labor camp system. The size of the population of a country like Canada is serving terms as prisoners.
Incredible.
So I would say that those intellectuals who try to convince American public that concentration camp system is a thing of the past are either conscientiously misleading public opinion, or they are not very intellectual people. They're selectively blind. They lack intellectual honesty when they say that.
Well, we've spoken about the intellectuals in this country and also the intellectuals in the Soviet Union. What about down at the broad mass level? Do the people in general, the working people, the workers in general in the Soviet Union, do they support the system? Do they tolerate it? What is their attitude?
Well, average Soviet citizen, if there is such an animal, of course, does not like the system because it hurts, it kills. He may not understand the reasons. He may not have enough information or educational background to understand. But I doubt very much there are many people who are conscientiously supporting the Soviet system. There are not such people in the USSR. Even those who have all the reasons to enjoy socialism, people like myself, who were a member of journalistic elite, they also hate the system for different reasons, though. Not because they lack material affluence, but because they are unfree to think, they're in constant fear, duplicity, split personality. And this is the greatest tragedy for my nation.
Well, what do you think are the chances of the people actually overcoming their system or replacing it?
There is a great possibility that system will sooner or later be destroyed from within. There is a self-destructive mechanism built into any socialist or communist or fascist system. Because there is lack of feedback, because the system does not rely upon loyalty of population. But until this Soviet junta is being supported by the Western so-called imperialists, that is, multinational companies, establishments, governments, and let's face it, intellectuals, so-called academia in the United States is famous for supporting the Soviet system. As long as the Soviet junta will keep on receiving credits, money, technology, grain deals, and political recognition from all these traitors of democracy or freedom, there is no hope, there is not much hope for changes in my country, and the system will not collapse by itself simply because it's being nourished by so-called American imperialism. This is the greatest paradox in history of mankind, when capitalist world supports and actively nourishes its own destructor.
Yeah. I think you're trying to tell us something.
Oh, yes.
Center.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to tell you that it has to be stopped unless you want to end up in Gulag system and enjoy all the advantages of socialist equality. Working for free, catching fleas on your body, sleeping on the planks of plywood in Alaska this time, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's where Americans will belong, unless they will wake up, of course, and force their government to stop aiding Soviet fascism.
Mm-hmm. Well, you told us a moment ago why you left the system. I'd like to hear the details of how you did it. It must have been a very dangerous thing.
It was not so dangerous. It was crazy. First of all, because defecting in India is virtually impossible, thanks to very strong pressure from the Soviet government.
Excuse me, you were in India on assignment at
yes,
that time.
Yes, I was working for the Soviet embassy in New Delhi as a press officer. Mm-hmm. And defecting for a Soviet diplomat is next to impossible. It's a suicide, as I said, because a great friend Indira Gandhi pushed a law through parliament which says, and I quote, "No defector from any country has the right of political asylum in any embassy on the territory of the Indian Republic," which is a masterpiece of hypocrisy. No other defector but the Soviet one needs a political asylum. So, knowing that perfectly well, I planned the craziest possible way to defect. I started counterculture in India. There were thousands of young American boys and girls with no shoes, long hair, smoking hash and marijuana, studying sometimes Indian philosophy, sometimes simply pretending that they studied. And they greatly annoyed Indian police, and they were laughing stock of Indians because obviously they were good for nothing students. I studied carefully where they congregate, what routes they travel, what language they speak, what do they smoke. And one day I simply joined a group of hippies to avoid detection of Indian police. I was dressed as a typical hippie with blue jeans, long camis shirts, with all kind of nice decorations like these, long hairs, I bought a wig, because for several weeks I had to turn myself from a conservative Soviet diplomat into a very progressive American hippie. And that was the only way that I could avoid detection. It was very interesting experience, but it was necessary, because from my own knowledge as a member of Soviet embassy staff, I knew that there were many cases when Soviet defectors were betrayed by Indian police, and also some Western embassies played a very dirty role in betraying the Soviet defectors. According to our information, there were some, I wouldn't call them double agents, but simply immoral people working for this for the United States embassy, and confiding in people like this would be a suicide. So I had to be extremely careful. I could not trust anyone, and that was the reason for such a crazy way to defect.
Well, had you been caught in the act of trying to get out, what would have happened to you?
Oh, most likely I would end up in concentration camp, or depending on the situation and on the whim of some bureaucrat in KGB. Maybe even executed. This is normal practice. Quietly, of course, not publicly. But that would be the end of my defection, of course.
Well, when did you finally make it to the United States?
In 1970, after about 6 months of debriefing in Athens by the CIA, and I presume FBI too, they let me go first to Germany, then to Canada. That was my decision. I had to change my identity to protect my family and my friends in USSR. And also, I was a little bit paranoid, knowing that both Soviet KGB and probably some double agents within American system may be after me. So I wanted to settle down as far away as possible. I requested CIA to give me some kind of new identity and just let me go on my own. And I settled in Canada. I was a student. I changed many professions, from farm help and laundry truck driver to language instructor and broadcaster for Canadian Broadcasting Corporations in Montreal.
Well, have you had any threats on your life or any unpleasant comments?
In about 5 years, KGB eventually discovered that I'm working for Canadian Broadcasting. I made a very big mistake. I started working for overseas service of CBC, which is similar to Voice of America, in Russian language. And of course, monitoring service in USSR picked up every new voice. Every new announcer they would make it a point to discover who he is. And in 5 years, sure enough, slowly but surely, they discovered that I am not Thomas Schumann, that I am Yuri Alexandrovich Bezmianov, and that I am working for Canadian Broadcasting, and undermining beautiful détente between Canada and USSR. And the Soviet ambassador Alexander Yakovlev made it his personal effort to discredit me. He complained to Pierre Trudeau, who is known to be a little bit soft on socialism. And the management of CBC behaved in a very strange, cowardly way, unbecoming to representatives of an independent country like Canada. They listened to every suggestion that Soviet ambassador gave, and they started shameful investigation, analyzing content of my broadcasts to USSR. And sure enough, they discovered that some of my statements were probably would be offending to the Soviet Politburo. So I had to leave my job. And of course, subtle intimidations. They would say something like, please cross the street carefully because, you know, traffic is very heavy in Quebec. And fortunately, I know about the psychology and the logic of activity of the KGB, and I never allowed myself to be intimidated. This is the worst thing. This is what they expect a person, a defector, to be intimidated. Once they spot that you are scared, they keep on developing that line, And then eventually you either had to give up entirely and work for them, or they neutralize you. They would definitely stop all kind of political activity, which they failed to do in my case, because I was stubbornly working for Canadian Broadcasting. And in response to their intimidations, I said that, look, this is a free country, and I'm as free as you are. And I also can drive very fast. And gun control is not yet established in Canada. So I had a couple of good shotguns in my basement. So welcome to visit me someday with your Kalashnikovs machine guns. So obviously it didn't work. Intimidation didn't work. So they tried different approach, as I described. They approach on the highest level, on the level of Canadian bureaucracy.
And on that level, they were
successful. On that level, they were successful. On individual level, they failed flat.
Mr. Bezmenov has brought a series of slides with him that he has taken from the Soviet Union, and I think this is a good time to take a look at the slides.
Yes.
Now, the viewers will be able to see these slides as we talk about them.
Yes, this is a collection of slides which are, some of them are snapshots from my family album. Some of them are documents which I smuggled from the Soviet embassy, and some are reproductions from local mass media. I usually show them to establish my credibility as a defector. This is a picture of my native town, Mykishchi, about 20 miles north from Moscow. Characteristically, there is a statue of Comrade Lenin in the central square. This is myself at the age of 7. Again, characteristically, under the statue of Comrade Stalin, extending his friendly hand to peoples of the world. At that age, of course, I was still idealistically minded young communist, and I still believe that sooner or later things will go for better. But I realized that the system stinks, that something is fishy, and that ideology is fake. And the propaganda about advanced Soviet agriculture simply didn't meet the criteria of reality. If they talk about abundance of food and there is none in the stores, it must be something wrong. My father was, he's on the left here, my father was officer of the General Staff of the Soviet Army. He was inspector of land forces, Soviet troops stationed in countries like Mongolia, Cuba, East European countries. Were he alive today, most likely he would be inspecting Soviet troops in Nicaragua, Angola, and many other parts of the world. Fortunately, he died, and he didn't see the disgrace, because deep inside, he was a Russian patriot. He didn't like the idea of expanding Soviet military might, especially in the areas where we were not welcome at all. Unlike many other military officers, he was reporting directly to the Minister of Defense, bypassing KGB and diplomatic service. In other words, he was a trusted military professional. And my impression that this type of people are much less hawkish and adventuristic than party bureaucrats in Kremlin. When American mass media describes Soviet military as potentially dangerous counterpart for Pentagon, I simply laugh, because I know better. I know that the most dangerous part of the Soviet power structures are not military at all. Most likely, if they come to power in my country, there will be more sensible negotiations for nuclear disarmament and withdrawal of the Soviet troops from many parts of the world.
But if someone from the party structure or the KGB structure were to give the orders for a military
they are professional military. But they, you see, the triangle of power and hate in USSR is the party at the top, the party elite, the oligarchy of the party, then the military and the KGB at the bottom. They hate each other. And the most hated triangle, the most hated corner of the triangle is the Communist Party bureaucrats. They are the most adventuristic, senile megalomaniacs. They can start war, I wouldn't be surprised. Not the military. They know what war is. At least my father did. This is the picture taken at the entrance of my Institute of Oriental Languages. It's a part of Moscow State University. I graduated in 1963. And I,
now, excuse me, which one were you on?
I am on the right.
You're on the right.
And on the left is my my schoolmate, Vadim Smirnov, who later was an apparatchik in the Central Committee of the Soviet Union Communist Party.
What is an apparatchik?
It's a function. It's something like civil service in British Empire. Someone who is never fired from the service. He stays there internally. He may not be promoted too high, but he's a dependable bureaucrat who will stay forever. I studied not only languages, but also history, literature, even music. I'm on this picture, I'm trying to learn how to play Indian musical instrument. I even tried to look like an Indian when I was second year student.
Not bad, right?
Yes, actually it was strongly encouraged by the instructors in my school, because the graduates of my school were later on employed as diplomats, foreign journalists, or spies. As every Soviet student, I was quote-unquote volunteering for harvesting grain in Kazakhstan. This is the biggest agricultural blunder of the Soviet government. But I didn't have much choice, of course, because the communist motto borrowed from the Bible says, "Those who do not work shall not eat," and you can see me eating, therefore I was working, and you can see how happy I was about it. I went through a very extensive physical and military training, including the military games suburban areas of Moscow. And here, for example, we are on a tour in Arkhangelsk area. And by the end of my training in school, I was recruited by the KGB. This picture was taken on that day, and you can see again how happy it feels to be recruited by the KGB.
Our conversation with Yuri Alexandrovich Bezmianov, who is a defector from the Soviet Union, a former propaganda agent for Novosti and the KGB, will continue after this message.
As every student in USSR, I went through very extensive physical and military training and civil defense training too. Unlike in the United States, where civil defense is virtually non-existent, zero, in USSR, every student, whatever his major subject, has to go through very extensive four-year military and civil defense training. You can see me here with a group of students during one of the war games near Moscow. The main idea, of course, is to prepare a huge reserve army of the USSR. Each student has to graduate as a junior lieutenant. In my case, it was administrative and military intelligence service. My first assignment was to India as a translator with the Soviet Economical Aid Group, building refinery complexes in Bihar State and Gujarat State. At that time, I was still naively idealistically believing that what I was doing contributes to the understanding and cooperation between the nations. It took me quite a number of years to realize that what we were bringing to India was a new type of colonialism, 1,000 times more oppressive and exploitative than any colonialism or imperialism in history of mankind. But at that time I was still hoping that, well, maybe it's not that bad, could be worse, and things may go for better. And I even tried to implement the beautiful Marxist motto, "Proletarians of all the countries unite." I tried to unite with a nice Indian girl, and I was fascinated by Indian culture, by the family life in this country. But obviously Communist Party had different plans for my genes, so I had to marry this beautiful Russian girl. In the span of my career, I married three times. Most of these marriages were marriages of convenience on advice from the Department of Personnel. This is normal practice in USSR. When a Soviet citizen is assigned to a foreign job, he has to be married, either to keep family in USSR as hostages, or, if it's a convenience marriage like mine, So that the husband and wife are virtually informers on each other to prevent defection or contamination by decadent imperialist or capitalist ideas. In my case, I hated that girl so much that the moment I landed in Moscow, we were divorced, and I married late the second time. By the end of my first assignment in India, I was promoted to the position of public relations officer. You can see me here translating a speech by a Soviet boss.
And you're on the right.
I'm on the right here, yes. And it was, the occasion was commissioning of the refinery complex in Bihar, Barauni. Back in Moscow, I was immediately recruited by Novosti Press Agency, which is the propaganda and ideological subversion front for the KGB. 75% of the members of the Novosti are commissioned officers of the KGB. The other 25 are, like myself, co-opted agents who are assigned to specific operations. In this particular case, you can see me talking to students of Lumumba Friendship University in Moscow. This is a huge school under the direct control of the KGB and Central Committee, where future leaders of the so-called national liberation movements are being educated and selected carefully. And some of them have absolutely, this, for example, is a group of students from Lumumba. They don't look like students at all. They look more like military, and that's exactly what they were. They were dispatched back to their countries to be leaders of the so-called national liberation movements, or to be translated into normal human language, leaders of international terrorist groups. Another area of activity when I was working for the Novosti was to accompany groups of so-called progressive intellectuals, writers, journalists, publishers, teachers, professors of colleges. You can see me here in Kremlin, I'm second on the left, with a group of Pakistani and Indian intellectuals. Most of them pretended they don't understand that we are actually working on behalf of the Soviet government and the KGB. They pretended that they are actually being guests, a VIP intellectual, that they are treated according to their merits and their intellectual abilities. For us, they were just a bunch of political prostitutes to be taken advantage for various propaganda operations. Therefore, you can see perfectly well the senior colleague of mine on the left doesn't really have that much respect on his face, and myself with a very skeptical smile, typical KGB sarcastic smile, anticipating another victim of ideological brainwashing. This is how a typical conference in Novosti headquarters in Moscow looked like. Sitting in the middle is Boris Burkov, the then director of Novosti Press Agency, high-ranking party bureaucrat in the Department of Propaganda. I'm standing next to a famous Indian poet, Sumitranandan Pant. He was famous because he was an author, he was the author of a famous poem titled Rhapsody to Lenin. That's why he was invited to USSR, and everything was paid by the Soviet government. Pay special attention to the number of bottles on the table. This is one of the ways to kill the awareness or curiosity of foreign journalists. One of my functions was to keep foreign guests permanently intoxicated the moment they land at Moscow airport. I had to take them to the VIP lounge and toast to friendship and understanding between the nations of the world, glass of vodka, then a second glass of vodka. And in no time, my guests would be feeling very happy. They would see everything in kind of pink, nice color. And that's the way I had to keep them permanently for the next 15 or 20 days. At certain point in time, I had to withdraw alcohol from them so that some of them, who are the most recruitable, would feel a little bit shaky, guilty, trying to remember what they were talking last night. That's the time to approach them with all kind of nonsense, such as joint communique or statement for Soviet propaganda. That's the time they are the most flexible. And of course, what they didn't understand, they didn't realize or pretended not to realize, that myself, who was drinking together with them, was not drinking at all. I had ways to get rid of alcohol through various techniques, including special pills which were given to me by my colleagues, but they were taking it seriously. In other words, they would consume quite a large volumes of alcohol and feel quite uneasy next morning. In 1967, the KGB attached me to this magazine, Look magazine. A group of 12 people arrived in USSR from the United States to cover the 50th anniversary of October Socialist Revolution in my country. From the first page to the last page, it was a package of lies, propaganda cliché, which were presented to American readers as opinions and deductions of American journalists. Nothing could be far from truth. These were not opinions. They were not opinions at all. They were the clichés which the Soviet propaganda wants American public to think that they think. Yeah, if it does make any sense at all. It sure does, because from the viewpoint of the Soviet propaganda, although there are some subtle criticisms of the Soviet system, the basic message is that Russia today is a nice, functioning, efficient system supported by majority of population. That's the biggest lie. And of course, American intellectuals and journalists from Look magazine elaborated on that untruth in various different ways. They intellectualized that lie. They found all kinds of justifications for telling lies to American public.
It was partly your job to make sure that they got these ideas,
yes,
and accepted them as their own ideas.
Right. Actually, even before they arrived to USSR, and they paid astronomical sum of money for that visit, they were submitted, this Novosti Press Agency developed so-called backgrounders, 20, 25 pages of information and opinions, which were presented to the journalists even before they bought their tickets to Moscow. They had to analyze the situation, and judging on their reaction to that backgrounder, the local Novosti representative or local Soviet diplomat in Washington, D.C. would assess whether they have, whether they be given visa to USSR or not.
So they were selected ahead of time.
They were pre-selected very carefully, and there is not much chance for honest journalists to arrive to USSR and to stay there for 1 year and to bring this package of lies back home. This, for example, is a central fold of the Look magazine. They presented this monument erected by Communist Party in Stalingrad as the symbol, personification of Russian military might. And they said in the article, which is published on the site, that Soviets are very proud of the victory in the Second World War. This is another big myth, a lie. Most sensible people would be proud to lose 20 million of their countrymen in a war which was started by Genosław Hitler and Comrade Stalin and paid by American multinationals. Most of the Soviet citizens look at this type of monuments with disgust and sorrow, because every family lost father, brother, sister, or child in the Second World War. Yet American journalists who were trying to appease, to please their hosts, presented this picture on the centerfold as the symbol and personification of Soviet national, they call it Russian national spirit. And it was greatest misconception and a very tragic misunderstanding. Of course, Look magazine was not distributed in USSR. The main audience was in the United States. But I presume that many Americans, millions of Americans who were reading Look magazine at that time, had absolutely wrong idea about the sentiments of my nation, about what the Soviets are proud of and what they hate. This is the group, you see the same lady with the sword in Stalingrad. This is the group of journalists. Myself is in the center with the same devilish smile. And Mr. Philip Harrington is on the extreme left there with his camera. This is the gentleman which was so deaf or so uninterested in what I had to say to him. This is the same picture, a blow-up of the same picture. Many guests from various countries, in this particular case from Asia and Africa, were taken by me as a Novosti Press Agency employee for a tour across Siberia, for example. We would show them typical kindergarten, you see. Nothing special by American standards, just nice children sitting, eating their breakfast or lunch. What they could not understand, or they pretended not to understand, that this is an exemplary kindergarten. This is not the kindergarten for average person or average family in the USSR. And we maintain that illusion in their minds. You can see myself under the red spot in the middle there, with the same business-like expression. I'm doing my job. That's what I'm assigned to do, and that's what I was paid to do. But deep inside, I still hope that at least some of these useful idiots would understand that what they are looking at has nothing to do with the level of affluence in my nation. This is a better picture which reflects the true spirit of the Soviet childhood. This picture was printed in a Canadian government publication by mistake. In the middle, you can see children playing on a small courtyard, and the caption goes, "This is a typical kindergarten in Siberia." What this idiot didn't understand, that it is not kindergarten at all. It is a prison for children of political prisoners. But there was not a single mentioning that what they were visiting actually was an area of concentration camps. And the job of people like myself to help them to not to notice that they are actually talking to prisoners. Most of the children were dressed, especially on the occasion of the foreigners' visit. Of course, there were no corpses on the ground. There were no machine gun guards. And it looks not very pleasant, as you see. It looks dull, but obviously it does not create an impression that this is actually a prison.
Well, did any of the journalists have the curiosity to ask about prisons and that kind of thing?
Yes.
They were in Siberia,
yes.
Is what you associate.
Some of them asked questions, and naturally we would give them, for the stupid question, we give them stupid answer. No, there are no prisons in Siberia. No, most of the people who you see are free citizens of USSR. They're very happy to be here, and they are contributing to the glory of the socialist system. Some of them pretended that they believe what I was telling them. And most of them, we may discuss it later, what are the motivations of these people? Why would they stubbornly bring lies to their own population through their own mass media? I have various answers to this. There is not a single explanation. It's a complex of explanations. It's fear, pure biological fear. They understand that they are on the territory of an enemy state, a police state. And just to save their rotten skins and their miserable jobs, their affluence back home, they would prefer to tell a lie than to ask truthful questions and report truthful information. Second, most of these schmucks were afraid to lose their jobs, because obviously if you tell truth about my country, you will not last long as a correspondent of New York Times or Los Angeles Times. They will fire you. What kind of correspondent are you? You obviously cannot find common language with Russians if they kick you out in 24 hours. So just by trying to be conformist to their own editorial bosses, they tried not to offend the sentiments of the Soviet administrators and people like myself. Deep inside, I hope they would insult my or offend my sentiments. Obviously, they preferred not to. Another reason... I refuse to believe it, but obviously there is another reason. Obviously, it's a greed. These people earn a lot of money. When they come back to USA, they claim that they are experts on my country. They write books which sell a million copies, titled like Russians, The Truth About Russia. Most of it is lie about Russia. Yet they claim to be Sovietologists. They play back myths about my country, the propaganda cliches. Yet, they are stubbornly resist the word of truth. If a person like Solzhenitsyn is either defecting or kicked out of USSR, they try all their best to discredit him and to discourage him. I don't have much chance to appear on national network with a true story about my country. But a useful idiot like Hendrik Smith or Robert Kaiser, they are big heroes. They come back from USSR. They say, oh, we were talking to dissidents in Russia. Big deal. So the dissidents are chasing American correspondents in the streets. And they are cowardly escaping from this contact.
For some strange reason, if you want to know more about Spain, you refer to Spanish writers. If you want to learn more about French, you read French writers. Even about Antarctica, I bet you would read Indians. Only about the Soviet Union, for some strange reason, you read Hendrix and Schmendrix and all kinds of Kissingers. Because they claim that they know more about my country. They know nothing, or next to nothing. Or they pretend that they know more than they actually do. I would say they are dishonest people who lack integrity and common sense and intellectual honesty. They bring back all kinds of stories like that. A kindergarten in Siberia. Omitting the most important fact, it's a prison for children of political prisoners. Another greatest example of monumental idiocy of American politicians. Edward Kennedy was in Moscow, and he thought that he is a popular, charismatic American politician who is easygoing, who can smile, dance at the wedding in Russian Palace of Marriages. What he did not understand, or maybe he pretended not to understand, that actually he was being taken for a ride. This is a staged wedding, especially to impress foreign media or useful idiots like Ed Kennedy. Most of the guests there, they had security clearance, and they were instructed what to say to foreigners. This is exactly what I was doing. You can see me in the same damn wedding palace in Moscow where Ed Kennedy was dancing here. He's smiling. He thinks he's very smart. From the viewpoint of Russian citizens who observe this idiocy, he's narrow-minded, egocentrical idiot who tries to earn his own popularity through participation in propaganda farces like this. Here you can see myself. On the right, again, exemplary Soviet bride. On the left, three journalists from various countries, Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Obviously, they enjoying the situation. They will go back home and write the reports. We were present on a regular Soviet wedding. They were not present on a regular Soviet wedding. They were present. They were part of a farce, of a circus performance. Another thing which I had to sometimes risking my life to explain to foreigners. Time magazine, for example, is very critical of South African racist regime. The whole article was dedicated to the shameful internal passport system where blacks are not allowing to live with whites. For some strange reason, for the last 14 years since my defection, nobody wanted to pay attention to my passport. This is my passport. It also shows my nationality, and it has a police rubber stamp, which is called propiska in Russian language, which assigns me to a certain area of residence. I cannot leave that area, same way as this black man cannot leave the area in South Africa. Yet we call South African government racist regime. Not a single Jane Schmonda or Fonda is brave enough, courageous enough to come to media and say, look, this is what happens in USSR. I send a copy of my passport to many American liberals and civil rights defenders and all the other useful idiots. They never bothered to answer me back. This shows what kind of integrity, what kind of honesty these people are. They are a bunch of hypocrites because they don't want to recognize a good example of racism in my country. This is the first stage of befriending a professor. You can see myself on the left with the same James Bond smile. On the right is my KGB supervisor, Comrade Leonid Mitrokhin, and in the middle, a professor of political science in Delhi University. The next stage would be to invite him to a gathering of Indo-Soviet Friendship Society. There he is sitting next to his wife before he is being sent to USSR for free trip. Everything is paid by the Soviet government. He was made to believe that he is invited to USSR because he is a talented, sober-thinking intellectual. Absolutely false. He is invited because he is a useful idiot, because he would agree and subscribe to most of the Soviet propaganda cliché. And when he is coming back to his own country, he is going for years and years to teach the beauties of Soviet socialism to newer and newer generations of his students, thus promoting the Soviet propaganda line. The KGB was even curious about this gentleman. It may look innocent. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, a great spiritual leader, or maybe a great charlatan and crook, depending on which, from which side you are looking at him. Beatles were trained at his ashram in Hardwar in India how to meditate. Neil Farrow and other useful idiots from Hollywood visited his school, and they returned back to the United States absolutely zonked out of their minds with marijuana, hashish, and crazy ideas of meditation. To meditate, in other words, to isolate oneself from the current social and political issues of your own country. To get into your own bubble, to forget about troubles of the world. Obviously, KGB was very fascinated with such a beautiful school, such a brainwashing center for stupid Americans. I was dispatched by the KGB to check what kind of VIP Americans attend this school.
That's you on the left.
Yes, I'm on the left. I was trying to get enrolled in that school. Unfortunately, the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi asked too much. He wanted $500 American for enrollment. But my function was not actually to get enrolled in the school. My function was to discover what kind of people from the United States attend this school. And we discovered that, yes, there are some influential members of family, public opinion makers of the United States, who come back with the crazy stories about Indian philosophy. Indians themselves look upon them as idiots, useful idiots. To say nothing about KGB, who looked at them as extremely naive, misguided people. Obviously, a VIP, say a wife of a congressman, or a prominent Hollywood personality, after being trained in that school, is much more instrumental in the hands of manipulators of public opinion and KGB than a normal person who understands, who looks through this type of fake religious training.
And why would they be more susceptible to manipulation?
I just mentioned that because, you see, a person who is too much involved in introspective meditation. You see, if you carefully look what Maharishi Mahesh Yogi is teaching to Americans, is that most of the problems, most of the burning issues of today can be solved simply by meditating. Don't rock the boat. Don't get involved. Just sit down, look at your navel, and meditate. And the things, due to some strange logic, due to cosmic vibration, will settle down by themselves. This is exactly what the KGB and Marxist-Leninist propaganda want from Americans, to distract their opinion, attention, and mental energy from real issues of the United States into a non-issues, into a non-world, non-existent harmony. Obviously, it's more beneficial for the Soviet aggressors to have a bunch of duped Americans than Americans who are self-conscious, healthy, physically fit, and alert to the reality. Mm-hmm. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi obviously is not on the payroll of the KGB. But whether he knows it or not, he contributes greatly to demoralization of American society. And he's not the only one. There are hundreds of those gurus who come to your country to capitalize on naivete and stupidity of Americans. It's a fashion. It's a fashion to meditate. It's a fashion not to be involved. So obviously, you can see that if KGB were that curious, if they paid my trip to Hardwar, if they assigned me to that strange job, obviously they were very much fascinated. They were convinced that that type of brainwashing is very efficient and instrumental in demoralization of the United States.
Our conversation with Yuri Alexandrovich Bezmianov, who is a defector from the Soviet Union, a former propaganda agent for Novosti and the KGB, will continue after this message.
This picture shows the part of the building of USSR embassy and my supervisors. On the left is Comrade Mehdi, an Indian communist, and on the right, Comrade Mitrokhin. my supervisors in the secret department of research and counter-propaganda. It has nothing to do with either research or counter-propaganda. Most of the activity of that department was to compile huge amount, volume of information on individuals who were instrumental in creating public opinion. Publishers, editors, journalists, actors, educationalists, professors of political science, members of parliament, representatives of business circles. Most of these people were divided roughly into groups. Those who would tow the Soviet foreign policy, they would be promoted to the positions of power through media and public opinion manipulation. Those who refused the Soviet influence in their own country would be character assassinated or executed physically come revolution. Same way as in the small town of Hue in South Vietnam, several thousands of Vietnamese were executed in one night when the city was captured by Viet Cong for only 2 days. An American CIA could never figure out how could possibly communists know each individual, where he lives, where to get him, and would be arrested in one night, basically in some 4 hours before dawn, put on a van, taken out of the city limits, and shot. The answer is very simple. Long before communists occupied the city, there was extensive network of informers, local Vietnamese citizens, who knew absolutely everything about people who are instrumental in public opinion, including barbers and taxi drivers. Everyone who was sympathetic to the United States was executed. Same thing was done under the guidance of the Soviet embassy in Hanoi, and same thing I was doing in New Delhi. To my horror, I discovered that in the files where people were doomed to execution, there were names of pro-Soviet journalists with whom I was personally friendly.
Pro-Soviet?
Yes. They were idealistically minded leftists who made several visits to USSR, and yet the KGB decided that counter-revolution or drastic changes in political structure of India, they will have to go.
Why is that?
Because they know too much. Simply because, you see, the useful idiots, the leftists who are idealistically believing in the beauty of Soviet socialist or communist or whatever system, when they get disillusioned, they become the worst enemies. That's why my KGB instructors specifically made a point, never bother the leftists. Forget about this political prostitute. Aim higher. This was my instruction. Try to get into large circulation, established conservative media. Reach, filter-reach movie makers, intellectuals, so-called academic circles, cynical, egocentric people who can look into your eyes with angelic expression and tell you a lie. These are the most recruitable people, people who lack moral principles, who are either too greedy or to suffer from self-importance. They feel that they matter a lot. These are the people who KGB wanted very much to recruit.
But also, to eliminate the others, to execute the others, don't they serve some purpose? Wouldn't they be the ones you rely
on? They serve purpose only at the stage of destabilization of a nation. For example, your leftists in the United States, all these professors and all these beautiful civil rights defenders, they are instrumental in the process of the subversion only to destabilize the nation. When their job is completed, they are not needed anymore. They know too much. Some of them, when they get disillusioned, when they see that Marxist Lenin has come to power, obviously they get offended. They think that they will come to power. That will never happen, of course. They will be lined up against the wall and shot. But they may turn into the most bitter enemies of Marxist-Leninists when they come to power. And that's what happened in Nicaragua. You remember most of the former Marxist-Leninists were either put to prison or one of them split, and now he's working against Sandinistas. It happened in Grenada when Maurice Bishop was already a Marxist. He was executed by a new Marxist who was more Marxist than this Marxist. Same happened in Afghanistan when first there was Taraki, who was killed by Amin, then Amin was killed by Babrak Karmal with the help of KGB. Same happened in Bangladesh when Mujibur Rahman, very pro-Soviet leftist, was assassinated by his own Marxist-Leninist military comrades. It's the same pattern everywhere. The moment they serve their purpose, all the useful idiots are used to either be executed entirely, all the idealistically minded Marxists, or were exiled or put in prison, like in Cuba. Many former Marxists are in Cuba, in prison. So most of the Indians who were cooperating with the Soviets, especially with our Department of Information of the USSR Embassy, were listed for execution. And when I discovered that fact, of course I was sick. I was mentally and physically sick. I thought that I'm going to explode one day during the briefing at the ambassador's office. I would stand up and say something that we are basically a bunch of murderers. That's what we are. It has nothing to do with friendship and understanding between the nation and blah, blah, blah. We are murderers. We behave as a bunch of thugs in a country which is hospitable to us, a country which with ancient traditions. But I did not defect. I tried to get the message across. To my horror, nobody wanted even to listen, least of all to believe what I had to say. And I tried all kinds of tricks. I would leak information through letters or lost documents or something like that. And still I got no message. The message was not published even in the conservative mass media of India. The immediate impulse to defect was Bangladesh crisis, which was described by American correspondents as Islamic grassroots revolution, which is absolute baloney. There was nothing to do with Islam, and there was no grassroots revolution. Actually, there are no grassroots revolutions, period. Any revolution is a byproduct of a highly organized group of conscientious and professional organizers, but has nothing to do with grassroots. In Bangladesh, it was nothing with grassroots. Most of the Awami League party members, Awami League means People's Party, were trained in Moscow in the high party school. Most of the Mukti Fauj leaders, Mukti Fauj in Bengali means People's Army, same as SWAPO and all kind of liberation armies all over the world, the same bunch of useful idiots. They were trained at Lumumba University and various centers of the KGB in Simferopol, in Crimea, and in Tashkent. So when I saw that Indian territory is being used as a jumping board to destroy East Pakistan, I saw myself, thousands of so-called students, traveling through India to East Pakistan, through the territory of India, and Indian government pretended not to see what was going on. They knew perfectly well, the Indian police knew it, the intelligence department of the Indian government knew it, the KGB of course knew it, and the CIA knew it. That was most infuriating, because when I detected and I explained to the CIA debriefers they should watch out because East Pakistan is going to erupt any moment, they said that I was reading too many James Bond novels. Anyway, so East Pakistan was doomed. One of my colleagues in the Soviet consulate in Calcutta, when he was dead drunk, he ventured into the basement to relieve himself, and he found the big boxes which said printed matter to Dhaka University. Dhaka is the capital of East Pakistan. And since he was drunk and curious, he opened one of the boxes and he discovered not printed matter, he discovered Kalashnikov guns and ammunition in there. Anyway, it's a long story. When I saw the preparations for the invasion into East Pakistan, obviously I wanted to defect immediately. The only thing I couldn't at that time make up my mind when and where and how. One of the reasons, of course, you see, I was in love with India. I mentioned that before. I spoke the languages. I socialized with people. And I understood that I had to act fast unless I want this beautiful country to be permanently and irreparably damaged by our presence. One of the reasons not to defect was, as you can see, I was living in relative affluence. Who the hell in a normal mind would defect and do what? To be abused by your media? To be called McCarthyist and fascist and paranoid? Or to drive a taxi in New York City? What for? What the hell for should I defect? To be abused by Americans? To be insulted in exchange for my effort to bring the truthful information about impending danger of subversion? As you can see, I was living in quite the comfortable conditions next to swimming pool, where Indians were not allowed, by the way. I was highly paid expert in propaganda. I had my family. I was respected by my nation. My career was cloudless. The third reason, how to defect with the family. To defect with the baby and the wife would be virtual suicide, because according to law, that hypocritical law which I quoted before, the Indian police will have to hand me over back to the KGB, and that will be the end of my detection and probably my life. Again, I cannot smuggle my wife because she was not quite sure what I was doing. She was not that idealistically involved, and she was definitely not in the total picture of what I was doing for the KGB. She would be shocked if I put her in my van and drive her to the American embassy or elsewhere. That would be a greatest danger. So again, I had to defect in such a way that my defection would look as simple disappearance. And there were many cases like that when the Soviet agents simply disappeared, either killed in action or, thanks to their curiosity and their close contacts with radicals, some of them were killed by the Marxists, by the way. It's happened in many African countries when the Soviet KGB were killed by Africans themselves. Not because they hated Marxist Leninists, but because they were simply trigger-happy bunch of unruly characters. If you give them machine gun, they will shoot. And some of the Soviets obviously were not careful enough to protect themselves, and they got into embarrassing situations when they were shot at the crossfire between factions of so-called liberation movements. Anyway, so I decided, as I said, to study the counterculture. I decided this probably would be the best way to disappear. I socialized with characters like this on the left. You see, he's a barefoot American hippie. It took me quite a long time to study exactly what they were doing and how to mix with them. But eventually I did it. Most of Indian newspapers carried my picture and promise of 2,000 rupees for information about my whereabouts. But they were looking for the wrong person because they obviously tried to stop a young Soviet diplomat in white shirt and tie, and this is how I looked at the time of defection. Nobody could possibly think that a Soviet diplomat would be as crazy as to join a bunch of hippies.
That's you.
Travel India and smoke hash. So I made it literally almost like a Hollywood-style detective story. From under the nose of the KGB in Bombay Airport, I landed the plane and I flew to Greece, where I was debriefed by the CIA. That's basically that's all for my slide.
We can turn off the projectors, and that's very interesting. Well, you spoke several times before about ideological subversion. That is a phrase that I'm afraid some Americans don't fully understand. When the Soviets use the phrase ideological subversion, what do they mean by it?
Ideological subversion is the process which is legitimate, overt, and open. You can see it with your own eyes. All you have to do, all American mass media has to do, is to unplug their bananas from their ears, open up their eyes, and they can see it. There is no mystery. There is nothing to do with espionage. I know that espionage intelligence gathering looks more romantic. It sells more deodorants through the advertising, probably. That's why your Hollywood producers are so crazy about James Bond type of thrillers. But in reality, the main emphasis of the KGB is not in the area of its intelligence at all. According to my opinion, and opinion of many defectors of my caliber, only about 15% of time, money, and manpower is spent on espionage as such. The other 85% is a slow process, which we call either ideological subversion or active measures, aktivnye meroприятия in the language of the KGB, or psychological warfare. What it basically means is to change the perception of reality of every American to such an extent that despite of the abundance of information, no one is able to come to sensible conclusions in the interest of defending themselves, their families, their community, and their country. It's a great brainwashing process which goes very slow and is divided in four basic stages. The first one being demoralization. It takes from 15 to 20 years to demoralize a nation. Why that many years? Because this is the minimum number of years which requires to educate one generation of students in the country of your enemy, exposed to the ideology of the enemy. In other words, Marxism-Leninism ideology is being pumped into the soft heads of at least three generations of American students without being challenged or counterbalanced by the basic values of Americanism, American patriotism. The result you can see, most of the people who graduated in the 60s, dropouts or half-baked intellectuals, are now occupying the positions of power in the government, civil service, business, mass media, educational system. You are stuck with them. You cannot get rid of them. They are contaminated. They are programmed to think and react to certain stimuli in a certain pattern. You cannot change their mind, even if you expose them to authentic information, even if you prove that white is white and black is black. You still cannot change the basic perception and the logic of behavior. In other words, these people, the process of demoralization is complete and irreversible. To get rid of society of these people, you need another 20 or 15 years to educate a new generation of patriotically minded and common sense people who would be acting in favor and in the interests of the United States society.
And yet these people have been programmed and, as you say, in place, and yeah, who are favorable to an opening with the Soviet concept. Mm-hmm. These are the very people who would be marked for extermination in this country?
Most of them, yes. Mm-hmm. Simply because the psychological shock when they will see in future what the beautiful society of equality and social justice means in practice, obviously they will revolt. They will be very unhappy, frustrated people. And the Marxist-Leninist regime does not tolerate these people. They will join the links of dissenters, mm-hmm, dissidents.
Yes.
Unlike in present United States, there will be no place for dissent in future Marxist-Leninist America. Here you can get popular like Daniel Ellsberg and filthy rich like Jane Fonda for being dissident, for criticizing your Pentagon. In future, these people will be simply squashed like cockroaches. Nobody is going to pay them nothing for their beautiful, noble ideas of equality. This they don't understand, and it will be the greatest shock for them, of course. The demoralization process in the United States is basically completed already. For the last 25 years, actually, it's over-fulfilled, because demoralization now reaches such areas where previously not even Comrade Andropov and all his experts would even dream of such a tremendous success. Most of it is done by Americans to Americans, thanks to lack of moral standards. As I mentioned before, exposure to true information does not matter anymore. A person who was demoralized is unable to assess true information. The facts tell nothing to him. Even if I shower him with information, with authentic proof, with documents, with pictures, even if I take him by force to the Soviet Union and show him concentration camp, he will refuse to believe it until he is going to receive a kick in his fat bottom. When a military boot crashes his balls, then he will understand, but not before that. That's the tragic of the situation of demoralization. So basically, America is stuck with demoralization, and unless, even if you start right now, here, this minute, you start educating new generation of Americans, it will still take you 15 to 20 years to turn the tide of ideological perception of reality back to normalcy and patriotism. The next stage is destabilization. This time, subverter does not care about your ideas and the patterns of your consumption. Whether you eat junk food and get fat and slab, it doesn't matter anymore. This time, and it takes only from 2 to 5 years to destabilize a nation, what matters is essentials: economy, foreign relations, defense systems. And you can see it quite clearly that in some areas, in such sensitive areas as defense and economy, the influence of Marxist-Leninist ideas in the United States is absolutely fantastic. I could never believe it 14 years ago when I landed in this part of the world that the process will go that fast. The next stage, of course, is crisis. It may take only up to 6 weeks to bring a country to the verge of crisis. You can see it in Central America now. And after crisis, with the violent changes of power, structure, and economy, you have so-called the period of normalization. It may last indefinitely. Normalization is a cynical expression borrowed from Soviet propaganda. When the Soviet tanks moved into Czechoslovakia in 1968, Comrade Brezhnev said, "Now the situation in brotherly Czechoslovakia is normalized." This is what will happen in the United States if you allow all these schmucks to bring the country to crisis, to promise people all kinds of goodies and the paradise on earth, to destabilize your economy, to eliminate the principle of free market competition, and to put a big brother government in Washington, D.C., with benevolent dictators like Walter Mondale, who will promise lots of things, never mind whether the promises are fulfillable or not. He will go to Moscow to kiss the bottoms of new generation of Soviet assassins, never mind. He will create false illusions that the situation is under control. Situation is not under control. Situation is disgustingly out of control. Most of the American politicians, media, and educational system trains another generation of people who think they are living at a peacetime. False. United States is in a state of war, undeclared total war against the basic principles and the foundations of this system. And the initiator of this war is not Comrade Andropov, of course. It's the system. However ridiculous it may sound, the world communist system or the world communist conspiracy, whether I scare some people or not, I don't give a hoot. If you are not scared by now, nothing can scare you. But you don't have to be paranoid about it. What actually happens now, that unlike myself, you have literally several years to live on unless the United States wake up. The time bomb is ticking, that every second the disaster is coming closer and closer. Unlike myself, you will have nowhere to defect to, unless you want to live in Antarctica with penguins. This is it. This is the last country of freedom and possibility.
Okay, so what do we do? What is your recommendation to the American people?
Well, the immediate thing that comes to my mind is, of course, there must be a very strong national effort to educate people in the spirit of real patriotism, number one. Number two, to explain them the real danger of socialist, communist, whatever, welfare state, big brother government. If people will fail to grasp the impending danger of that development, nothing ever can help the United States. You may kiss goodbye to your freedom, including freedoms to homosexuals, to prison inmates, all the freedom will vanish, evaporating in 5 seconds, including your precious lives. The second thing, the moment at least part of the United States population is convinced that the danger is real, they have to force their government. And I'm not talking about sending letters, signing petitions, and all this beautiful, noble activity. I'm talking about forcing United States government to stop aiding communism. Because there is no other problem more burning and urgent than to stop the Soviet military-industrial complex from destroying whatever is left of the free world. And it is very easy to do. No credits, no technology, no money, no political or diplomatic recognition, and of course no such idiocy as grain deals to USSR. The Soviet people, 270 million of Soviets, will be eternally thankful to you if you stop aiding a bunch of murderers who sit now in Kremlin and whom President Reagan respectfully calls government. They do not govern anything, least of all such complexity as the Soviet economy. So basic, two very simple, maybe two simplistic answers or solutions, but nevertheless, they are the only solutions. Educate yourself. Understand what's going on around you. You are not living at a time of peace. You are in a state of war. And you have precious little time to save yourself. You don't have much time, especially if you are talking about young generation. There's not much time left for convulsions and sexual masturbation to the beautiful disco music. Very soon it will go, just overnight. If we are talking about capitalists or wealthy businessmen, I think they are selling the rope on which they will hang very soon. If they don't stop, if they cannot curb their unsettled desire for profit, and if they keep on trading with the monster of the Soviet communism, they are going to hang very soon. And if they will pray to be killed, but unfortunately they will be sent to Alaska probably to manage industry of slaves. It's simplistic. I know it sounds unpleasant. I know Americans don't like to listen to things which are unpleasant. But I have decided not to tell you the stories about such idiocies as microfilm James Bond type espionage. This is garbage. You don't need any espionage anymore. I have come to talk about survival. It's a question of survival of this system. And you may ask me, what is it in for me? Survival, obviously, because as I said, I am now in your boat. If we sing together, we will sing beautifully together. There is no other place on this planet to defect to.
Subversion is the term, if you look in a dictionary or criminal code to that matter, usually is explained as a part of activity to destroy things like religion, government system, political, economical system of a country. And usually it's linked to espionage and such romantic things as blowing up bridges, sidetracking trains, clock and dagger activity in Hollywood style. What I'm going to talk about now has absolutely nothing to do with the cliché of espionage or KGB activity of collecting information. So the greatest mistake or misconception, I think, is that whenever we are talking about KGB, for some strange reason, starting from Hollywood movie makers to professors of political science and quote-unquote experts on Soviet affairs, or Kremlinologists as they call themselves, they think that the most desirable thing for Andropov and the whole KGB is to steal blueprints of some supersonic jet, bring it back to Soviet Union and sell it to the Soviet military-industrial complex. It's only partly true. If we take the whole time, money, and manpower that the Soviet Union and KGB in particular spends outside of USSR border, we will discover, of course there are no official statistics unlike with CIA or FBI, that the espionage as such occupies only 10 to 15% of money, time, and manpower. 15% of the activity of KGB. The rest, 85%, is always subversion. And unlike a dictionary of English, Oxford Dictionary, subversion in Soviet terminology means always a destructive, aggressive activity aimed to destroy the country, nation, or geographical area of your enemy. So there's no romantics in there, absolutely. No blowing up bridges, no microfilms in Coca-Cola cans, nothing of that sort. No James Bond nonsense. It's most of this activity is overt, legitimate, and easily observable if you give yourself time and trouble to observe it. But according to the law
and law enforcement systems of the Western civilization, it's not a crime. Exactly, because of misconception, manipulation of terms. We think that subverter is a person who is going to blow up our beautiful bridges. No. Subverter is a student who comes for exchange, a diplomat, an actor, an artist, a journalist like myself was 10 years ago. Now, subversion is an activity which is a two-way traffic. You cannot subvert an enemy which doesn't want to be subverted. If you know the history of Japan, for example, before the 20th century, Japan was a closed society. The moment a foreign boat comes to the shores of Japan, the Imperial Japanese Army politely tells them to get lost. And if an American salesman comes to the shore of Japan, let's say 60 or 70 years from now back, and says, oh, I have a very beautiful vacuum cleaner for you, you know, with the good financing, please leave us, we don't need your vacuum cleaner. If they don't leave, they shoot them to preserve their culture, ideology, traditions, values, intact. You were not able to subvert Japan. You cannot subvert Soviet Union because the borders are closed. The media is censored by the government. The population is controlled by the KGB and internal police. With all the beautiful glossy pictures of Time magazine and Magazine America, which is published by the American embassy in Moscow, you cannot subvert Soviet citizens because the magazine never reaches Soviet citizens. It's collected from the newsstands and thrown to garbage can. Subversion can be only successful when the initiator, the actor, the agent of subversion has a responsive target. It's a two-way traffic. The United States is a receptive target of subversion. There is no response similar to that one from the United States to the Soviet Union. It stopped halfway somewhere. It never reaches here. The theory of subversion goes all the way back 2,500 years ago. The first human being who formulated the tactics of subversion was a Chinese philosopher by the name of Sun Tzu. To 3,500 years B.C. He was an advisor for several imperial courts in ancient China. And he said, after long meditation, that to implement state policy in a warlike manner is the most counterproductive, barbaric, and inefficient to fight on a battlefield. You know that war is continuation of state policy, right? So if you want successfully to implement your state policy and you start fighting, this is the most idiotic way to do it. The highest art of warfare is not to fight at all, but to subvert anything of value in the country of your enemy. Until such time that the perception of reality of your enemy is screwed up to such an extent that he does not perceive you as an enemy, and that your system, your civilization, and your ambitions look to your enemy as an alternative, if not desirable, then at least feasible. Better red than dead. That's the ultimate purpose. The final stage of subversion, after which you can simply take your enemy without a single shot being fired, if the subversion is successful. This is basically what subversion is. As you see, not a single mentioning of blowing up bridges. Of course, some of you didn't know about blowing up bridges. Maybe there were not that many bridges at that time. But the basics of subversion is being taught to every student of KGB school in USSR and to officers of military academies. I'm not sure if the same author is included in the list of reading for American officers, to say nothing about ordinary students of political science. I had difficulty to find the translation of Sun Tzu in the library of a university in Toronto and later on here in Los Angeles. But it's a book which is not available. It is forced to every student in USSR. Every student who is taught to be dealing further in his future career with foreigners. What subversion is? Basically, it consists of four periods, time-wise. If we start from here and go this way, time, right? This is the beginning point. The first stage of subversion is the process which is called, basically, demoralization. It says for itself what it is. It takes from, say, 15 to 20 years to demoralize a society. Why 15 or 20 years? This is the time sufficient to educate one generation of students or children. One generation. One lifetime span of a person, a human being, which is dedicated to study, to shaping up the outlook, ideology, personality. No more, no less. Usually it takes from 15 to 20 years. What it includes? It includes influencing, or by various methods, infiltration, propaganda methods, direct contacts, doesn't really matter. I will describe them later. Of various areas where public opinion is formulated or shaped. Religion, educational system, social life, administration, law enforcement system, military, of course, and labor and employer relations, economy. Okay? Five areas. I will not write them down because we'll not have enough space. Sometimes when I describe all the methods, students ask me question, are you sure this is the result of the Soviet influence? Not necessarily. You see, the tactic of subversion about which I'm talking is similar to the martial art, the Japanese martial art. If some of you are familiar with that tactic, probably you will remember that if an enemy is bigger and heavier than yourself, it would be very painful to resist his direct strike. If a heavier person wants to strike me in the face, it would be very naive and counterproductive to stop his blow. The Chinese and Japanese judo art tells us what to do. First to avoid the strike, then to grab the fist and continue his movement in the direction where it was before, right? Until the enemy crashes in the wall. You see? So, what happens here? The target country obviously does something wrong. If it's a free democratic society, there are many different movements within the society. There are obviously, in every society, there are people who are against the society. They may be simple criminals, ideologically in disagreement with the state policy, conscientious enemies, simply psychotic personalities who are against anything. Right? And finally, there are a small group of agents of a foreign nation, bought, subverted, recruited. Right? The moment all these movements will be directed in one direction, right? This is the time to catch that movement and to continue it until the movement forces the whole society into collapse, into crisis, right? So that's exactly the martial art tactic. We don't stop an enemy. We let him go. We help him to go in the direction we want them to go. Okay? So, on the stage of demoralization, obviously there are tendencies in each society, in each country, which are going to opposite direction from the basic moral values and principles, to take advantage of these movements, to capitalize on them, is the main purpose of the originator of subversion. So we have religion, we have education, we have social life, we have power structure, we have labor relations, unions, and finally we have law and order. One, two, three, four, five, six. Okay? These are the areas of application of subversion. What does it mean exactly? In case of religion, destroy it, ridicule it, replace it with various sects, cults, which bring people's attention, faith, whether it is naive, primitive, doesn't really matter. As long as the basically accepted religious dogma is being slowly eroded and taken away from the supreme purpose of religion, to keep people in touch with the supreme being, that serves the purpose. Therefore, replace accepted, respected religious organizations with fake organizations. Distract people's attention from the real faith and attract them to various different faiths. Education. Distract them from learning something which is constructive, pragmatic, efficient. Instead of mathematics, physics, foreign languages, chemistry, teach them history of urban warfare, natural food, home economy, your sexuality, anything, as long as it takes you away, okay? Social life, replace traditionally established institutions and organizations with fake organizations. Take away the initiative from people. Take away the responsibility from naturally established links between individuals, group of individuals, and society at large, and replace them with artificially, bureaucratically controlled bodies. Instead of social life and friendship between neighbors, establish social workers institutions, the people who are on payroll of whom? Society? No. Bureaucracy. The main concern of social workers is not your family, not you, not social relations between groups of people. The main concern is to get the paycheck from the government. What will be the result of their social work doesn't really matter. They can develop all kind of consciousness to show them, to show to the government and to the people that they're useful. Okay. Away from the natural links. Power structure. Okay. The natural bodies of administration, which are traditionally either elected by people at large or appointed by elected leaders of society, are being actively substituted by artificial bodies. The bodies of people, groups of people, whom nobody elected. Never. As a matter of fact, most of the people don't like them at all, and yet they exist. One of such groups is media. Who elected them? How come they have so much power? Almost monopolistic power on your mind. They can rape your mind. But who elected them? How come they have a nerve to decide what is good and what is bad for the elected by you, president, and his administration? Who the hell are they? Spiro Agnew, who was hated by the liberal left, called them a bunch of enfeebled snobs. And that's exactly what they are. They think they know. They don't. The level of mediocrity in a big establishment like New York Times, Los Angeles Times, major television network, you don't have to be excellent journalist. You have to be exactly a mediocre journalist. That's easier to survive. There's no competition anymore. You have your good, nice income, $100,000 a year. That's it. Whether you are better or worse doesn't really matter anymore. As soon as you're smiling to the camera and do your job. That's it. No more competition. power structure slowly is eroded by the bodies and groups of people who do not have neither qualification nor the will of people to keep them in power, and yet they do have power. Okay. Together with that, there is another process. Law enforcement, law and order organization and structure is being eroded. For the last 20, 25 years, if you see old movies and new movies, you can see that in new movies, a policeman, an officer of the United States Army looks dumb, angry, psychotic, paranoid. A criminal looks nice, kind of, well, he smokes hash and shoots the whatever drug, but basically he's a nice human being, he's creative. And he's unproductive only because society oppresses him. Whereby a general of Pentagon is always, by definition, a dumb, a war maniac. A policeman is a pig, rude policeman. He abuses his power. You know? A generality, generalization like that. The hatred, the mistrust to the people who are supposed to protect you and enforce law and order. Moral relativity. The Angela Buono process lasted 2 years in Los Angeles. And yet there are still some lawyers who say, look, he's a nice character, as a matter of fact. There was some witness who said, also a criminal, who said, well, he's a nice guy. I asked him one day to burn a house of my enemy, and he wouldn't do it. Nice fella. A worker. A slow substitution of basic moral principles, whereby a criminal is not a criminal, actually. He's a defendant. Even if his guilt is proven, there is still a doubt to kill or not to kill, to be or not to be. Thou shalt not kill, yes. But this line may not necessarily be applicable to a murderer. Thou shalt not murder. That should be the presumption, not that thou shalt not kill. Okay, labor relations. At this stage, within 15 to 20 years, we destroy the traditionally established links of bargaining between employer and employee. The classical Marxist-Leninist theory of natural exchange of goods. A person A has 5 sacks of grain and person B has 5 pairs of shoes. And the natural exchange without money is when they bargain between each other. And only with the introduction of the third force C, an entirely third foreign stranger who says, no, don't give him 5 sacks of grain, give it to me. And you give me your 5 pairs of shoes and I will distribute it accordingly. So that the economy will go. This is the death of natural exchange, the death of natural bargaining. Well, trade unions were established 100 years ago. The objective was to improve working conditions and to protect the rights of workers from those employers who were abusing their right because they had more money. Objectively, at that time, initially, the trade union movement did work. What we see now is that the bargaining process is no longer resulting in the compromise, which is leading objectively to betterment of working conditions and increase of salary. What we see is that after each prolonged strike, the workers lose. Even if they have 10% increase of their salaries, they cannot catch up due to inflation and due to missed time. More than that, millions of people suffer from that strike because economy now is interdependent. It's intertwined like one body. If previously steel workers, say 100 years ago, could strike and nobody would suffer, now it's impossible anymore. If a garbage collector strikes today, the rest of the multi-million city is stinking. I mean, there's no more service. In Quebec, for example, we had the electricians who were on strike in the middle of winter. You can freeze your bottom, and they still were on strike. Did they catch up with the salary? No, they lost. Who benefited? The leaders of trade unions. What is the motivation for strike? Improving of workers' condition? No, obviously it's not. Then what is it? Ideology. To prove to these capitalists and the obedient horde of workers, like sheep, follow these people. And they cannot disobey. Why? Because if they do, you know what happens to them. Pickets, murders, shooting truck drivers by picketers. In Montreal, for example, I saw with my own eyes when I was correspondent of CBC, International Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, when the workers of aircraft factories destroyed computers and the equipment in the factory. And the administration employed strike breakers, their cars were turned upside down and burned. Their houses were burned, their kids were intimidated, and some victims were there. Of that you can be sure. Why? To improve conditions of workers? No. Ideology. Okay, so this is what happens, basically. It may or may not happen without the help of the Soviet Union, but the natural tendencies are being greatly taken advantage of and capitalized by the Soviet propaganda systems. How? Whenever trade union strikes, we have influx of propaganda, mass media, ideological dissemination. The workers' right, and we repeat it like Paris. Yes, workers' right. Who's right? Workers? No. The only freedom of worker to sell his labor according to his own desire and will is taken away from him. By whom? By trade union boss. Unlimited power is given. Responsibility. I want to sell my labor not for $2.50 an hour, but for $2. I don't have right. My freedom is denied to me. I know that if I sell my work for $2 an hour, not for $3 an hour, I will compete better with the other guy who is lazy and more greedy. I don't need $3. I need only $2. No, I was made to believe by media, by business, by advertising agencies that I need more and more and more. Have you ever heard any advertising on TV to consume less? No. No way. Whether you need a six-cylinder car or not, you have to buy it. And hurry up. When I was driving here on the local radio station, an excited announcer said, "You hurry up, rush and save. There is a penthouse sale." Save by buying more. Of course. It would be too naive to expect that KGB makes this advertising agency to do such a crazy commercial. No, of course not. But what we did when I was working for Novosti Press, we would snowplow editorial offices, student organizations, religious groups, with literature of class struggle. It's not directly Marxism-Leninist propaganda. Then a propaganda of the legitimate aspirations of working class, betterment of life, equality. Mind you, President Kennedy once said, "We will make America to believe that people are born equal." Are people born equal? Is there any mentioning in the Bible or any other holy scripture in any religion, if you don't believe me, go to the library and check it. There is not a single word about equality. Just the opposite. By your deeds, God will judge you. What you do is important. The merit of your personality. You cannot legislate equality. If you want to be equal, you have to be equal. You have to deserve it. And yet we build our society on the principle of equality. We say people are equal. We know it is false. It's a lie. Some people are tall and stupid. Others are short, bold, and clever. If we make them equal by force, if we put the principle of equality in the basis of our social political structure, is the same thing as building a house on sand. Sooner or later, it will collapse. And that's exactly what happened. And we, as Soviet propaganda makers, are trying to push you in the direction which you go yourself. Equality. Yes, equality. People are equal. Land of equal opportunities. Is it true or not? Think about it. Equal opportunities. Should there be equal opportunities for me and for a lazy bastard who comes here from some other country and immediately registers as a welfare recipient benefit? I never received a single dot. No, sorry, I did receive once. But I never applied for welfare. For the 13 years, I took any job. Security guard, journalist, taxi driver, anything. Well, I was reckless, but some people don't like it. They immediately. So why should we be? Why should we have equal opportunities? Why?
Equal opportunity to excel.
Equal opportunity in equal circumstances, yes, but you know people are different. To excel, yes, provided we reach the same level of excellency, perfection, which is hypothetical distant future. Yes, maybe, but we know perfectly well that even with the best intentions, people could not be equal. Why should we have equality in the legal system? Myself, I'm considering myself a law-abiding citizen, and a person who comes here to rob and shoot, say, the United States administration under Carter, imported thousands of Cuban criminals. They were non-criminals. Yet they were accepted. Do you think it's fair if myself and my wife from Philippines who work like a, excuse me, horse as a lab technician in a hospital should have the same rights as a criminal from Cuba? Why? And yet we repeat as parrots, equality, equality, equality. And the Soviet propaganda system helps us to believe that equality is something which is desirable. Democracy, as it was established by fathers of this country, of this system, in the last century, is not equality. It's the system where different people, unequal people, have a chance to survive and help each other in constant competition, in constant perfection, not in equality, which is superimposed from a godfather or a nice person in Washington, D.C. And the absolute equality exists in Soviet Union, quote-unquote equality. Everybody is equal in dirt, except some people are more equal than the others in Politburo. So, the moment you bring a country to the point of almost total demoralization, when nothing works anymore, when you are not sure if it is right or wrong, good and bad, but there's no division between evil and good. When even the leaders of church sometimes say, well, violence for the sake of justice, especially social justice, is justified in countries like Nicaragua, El Salvador, well, maybe Rhodesia, and we listen to them and say, yeah, probably it's true. Is it true? No, it is not true. Violence is not justified, especially for the sake of quote-unquote social justice introduced by Marxist Leninist, that is my former colleague from Novosti Press Agency. Okay, so where is that point? The next step is destabilization. Again, this word says for itself what it is. To destabilize all the relations, all the accepted institutions and organizations in a country of your enemy. How you do it? You don't have to send up a battalion of KGB agents to blow up bridges. No. You let them do it themselves. The area of application is, again, it's narrower now. Not like the previous case. The overt legitimate actions of the KGB in this case would be hardly noticeable. There is no crime if a professor who recently went to USSR introduces a course of Marxism-Leninism in a Californian college, for example. Nobody is going to come to his doorstep and say, okay, mister, come, you're under arrest. No, it's not a crime. It's not even considered a moral crime against your country. So the area of application here is narrowing down to economy, again, labor relations, right? To law and order. Plus military. And economy, law and order. Yes, and again, the media, but wider scope, little bit different. I'll explain when. Okay, basically three areas. Economy. The radicalization of bargaining process. If on that stage we still could achieve, theoretically, some positive compromise between the negotiating sides with, say, the introduction of arbitrary judges, third side, objectively judging the demands of both sides. Here it's radicalization. On the stage of destabilization, we cannot come to compromise even within a family. The husband and wife couldn't figure out which is better. Husband wants his kids to eat at the table, and wife wants him, a child, to roam around the room and drop food all over the floor. They cannot come to compromise unless they start a fight. It's impossible to reach a compromise, constructive compromise, between neighbors. Some people say, I don't like you to work in your lawn at that time, because exactly at that time I'm walking my dog and he's getting nervous. He cannot pass his bowels, you know. So they cannot compromise. They go to a civil court or something like that. Radicalization of human relations. No more compromise. Fight, fight, fight. The normal, traditionally accepted relations are destabilized. The relations between teachers and students in schools and colleges. Fight. The relations between, in economical sphere, between laborers and employers are further radicalized. No more acceptance of the legitimacy of demands of workers. Unlike Japanese, with the theory Z, if you ever heard about it, where the workers are involved in the decision-making process, therefore they don't have moral incentive to fight their bosses. In the United States, it's just the opposite. The harder is the fight, the better. The more heroic they look. When the Greyhound network was on strike recently, the correspondents of local TV networks all over the United States were approaching the strikers, and they said, oh yes, we are doing something nice. They looked like heroes and they were proud. There was some family, the husband was a bus driver. Now they decided in the protest against the bosses to camp somewhere in the forest. And they were presented to the audience as a heroic, nice people. You see? The violent clashes between passengers, picketers, and the strikers are presented as something normal. 10, 15, 20 years ago, we would be angry. We said, why so much hatred? Today we are not. We say, well, commonplace. Radicalization, militarization sometimes. As I explained on that stage, I took a step a little bit further. Shooting people. Okay, law and order now also is pushed into the area where previously people settled their differences peacefully and legitimately. Now, we are getting with this court cases, in the smallest irrelevant cases, we cannot solve our problems anymore. The society at large becomes more and more antagonistic between individuals, between groups of individuals, and the society at large. The media puts himself in the opposition to the society in general, at large, separate, alienated, Okay? On that stage, you remember I was talking a couple of hours ago about the sleepers. That's when the students from, say, United States, if they are trained in Lumumba University, or developing nations, the students I was dealing with, are being sent back from the Soviet Union here. Or if they were already in the United States, in the country, which is the object of subversion, they spring to action. The sleepers go up. They slept for 15 to 20 years. Now they become leaders of groups, preachers, I don't know, public figures. Prominently, they act. They actively include themselves in a political process. All of a sudden, we see a homosexual. 15 years ago, he did his dirty job and nobody cared. Now he makes it a political issue. He demands recognition, respect, human rights, and he rallies a large group of people. And there are violent clashes between him and police, his group, and ordinary people. No matter what, it's black against white, yellows against green, doesn't matter where the division line goes. As long as this group comes into antagonistic clash, sometimes militantly, sometimes with firearms, that is destabilization process. The sleepers, many of whom are simply KGB agents, become leaders of the process of destabilization. Doesn't mean that Comrade Andropov sends Comrade Ivanov to the United States. The person who takes care is already here. He is a respected citizen of the United States. Sometimes he gets money from various foundations for his legitimate struggle for, I don't know, human rights, women rights, kid lib, prison lib, whatever. There are sympathetic Americans who donate their money to him. This stabilization process usually leads directly to the process of crisis. In case of developing nations, that's the area where I was active, the process starts when the legitimate bodies of power, the social structure collapse. It cannot function anymore. So instead, we have artificial body injected into society, such as non-elected committees. You remember I was talking about them here. Social workers who are not elected by people, media who are self-appointed rulers of your opinion, some strange groups which claim that they know how to lead society forward. They don't usually. All they care is how to collect donations and sell their own concocted ideology, mixture of religion and ideology. Here, we have all this artificial body claiming power. If the power is denied to them, they take it by force. In case of Iran, for example, all of a sudden we have revolutionary committees. What kind of revolution? There was no revolution yet, and yet they had the committees. They were taking power of judgment. They had the power of execution. They had the power of legislation, and they had the power of judicial. All of them combined in one person, who is half-baked intellectual, sometimes graduated from Harvard University or Berkeley. He comes back to his country and he says that he knows the answer to all the social economical problems. Okay? Crisis is when society cannot function any more productively. It collapses, obviously. That's the word for crisis. So therefore, the population at large is looking for a savior. The religious groups are expecting a messiah to come. The workers say, we have family to feed. Let's have a strong government, maybe socialist government, centralized. When somebody put their employers on their plates and let us work. We are sick and tired of going to strike and missing overtime and all that stuff. We need some strong man, strong government, a leader, a savior is needed. Population is sick and tired already. And here we are. We have a savior. either a foreign nation comes in, or the local group of leftists, Marxists, no matter what they call themselves, Sandinista, a reverend or some sort, Bishop Muzorewa, like in Zimbabwe, doesn't matter. A savior comes and says, I will lead you. So we have two alternatives here. Civil war, an invasion. Okay? See how it goes? Civil war, we know what it is. Lebanon is the best example. The civil war, which was artificially implanted in Lebanon by injection of force of PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization. Invasion, we had in many other countries like Afghanistan, name any East European country, it was invaded by the Soviet Army. But the result is the same. The next stage is normalization. Normalization is a very ironic word, of course. It is borrowed from 1968 situation in Czechoslovakia, when the Soviet propaganda, and after them New York Times, declared the country